Welcome to the 17th episode of Reverse Rep Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
And even though Sachin didn't get his 100 at Lord's, we're still the podcast that believes in fairy tales.
We do, and this series is really turning into a bit of a roller coaster. Really, I have no idea what's going to happen.
Six days in, and you reckon we've already got a roller coaster?
Well, 6 days in. It's worth saying that we're recording this on the Friday night after the first day of the Trent Bridge Test. We prepared everything, having seen the Lord's Test and everything that went on there, and everything that's happened in the first day at Trent Bridge with England being bowled out pretty cheaply on potentially a pretty good wicket has changed everything. So in a sense, let's forget about Nottingham because I haven't seen it. I don't think you've seen it yet. Looking back to the first test of the series at Lords, what do you think was the difference between the two sides?
Well, I mean, I think it's sort of the obvious answer, but I mean, the absence of Zahir Khan was huge. I mean, I think it's not difficult to make the argument that along with that James Anderson, I mean, those two are the best exponents of swing, I mean, possibly in the world at the moment. I mean, you know, some other, a couple of Pakistani bowlers, maybe Dale Steyn have something to say about that. But aside from that, I mean, I actually thought Kumar and Sharma deserve a lot of credit for the way they went about their business. I mean, it's very difficult, especially when Harbhajan was struggling to hold up an end. But really, they were exposed, and you know, the fact that I think Khan finished with something ludicrous like 2 for 11 as his figures while fit, you know, showed a lot about the kind of bowler he is.
I think there were just so many, because Khan was one of those questions which we talked before the series about the fact that Zahir Khan was such a huge influence in the Indian bowling lineup and was kind of the linchpin of that, of their attack. And there were lots of questions about Zahir Khan. There were questions about Tendulkar and whether in a test that, I mean, there was such incredible pressure on him to score his 100th in Lords,
I mean,
in the 100th test match between England and India in the 2000th test match of all time. The pressure he must have been feeling was huge. So that could have gone either way. He could have gone out and scored 350 and taken the game away.
Those scenes with Tendulkar going out to have a net and being crowded by Indian fans desperate to touch him, I mean, I think that was the moment when I think a lot of us realised, and also that fifth day, you know, fans queuing from 2 in the morning, you realise that we really have got a massive series on our hands. I mean, fans have bought into it on the way. I mean, the other thing I thought a decisive difference that has been commented about a lot less was actually the way the batting order, the lower batting order, especially the tail, really contributed. I mean, England's tail wagged pretty decisively.
Well,
I mean,
Matt Prior and Stuart Broad in the second innings, because that fourth day, which was just a fantastic day of Test cricket, when England looked out of it at the beginning, India came back when they were bowling, took some quick wickets early in the morning, put India right back in contention, and then Broad and Prior came back and really took the game away from
India. And Stuart Broad,
India,
I think, deserves a vast amount of credit. I mean, under a huge amount of pressure, had suffered a lot of criticism.
Yeah.
Not only bowled well, but having got a golden duck in the first innings, batted superbly in the second, and has batted really well at Trent Bridge today again. I mean, decisive knocks in both cases.
He has, and he was another one of these players who was a bit of a question mark for England, as to he could have gone either way. And both his bowling and his batting went in England's favour. And I think there were just so many little battles within the game that fell in England's favour.
Well, I think you've got to credit, I mean, I was one of the people who, I was a little bit concerned about that sort of stroppy teenager side abroad, you know, the toys being thrown out of the pram. And I would have dropped him for Lords. I would only say I just didn't feel his head was in the right place, and Bresnan really felt like the safer option. But Broad responded so well.
Particularly with those DRS decisions, some of the LB decisions.
He was not happy about the Sachin one, was he, on the
when it was absolutely plumb, and he turned to Billy Bowden, didn't he? And Billy Bowden said it was that there was an inside edge when there, or even an outside edge when there quite obviously wasn't a bat within a country mile of the ball.
And I suppose, I mean, to be fair to the England selectors, again, for, you know, it's been quite regular recently, they've had faith when, frankly, the press and a lot of the fans haven't, and it's really worked, you know, it's worked for England. I mean, what do you think in terms of, you know, looking more at this India side again, it was kind of not entirely new look side, but there were changes for
there were new elements to it.
I mean, who impressed for you, who didn't?
I thought Kumar, as you say, with Zahir Khan out of the side, a lot of the pressure fell onto Kumar particularly, who I thought bowled fantastically. There's going to be a question about whether his kind of potentially military medium. It's been interesting how the press have reacted to his bowling, because a lot of people have come out and said, look, this is wonderful because it's a good old-fashioned type of swing bowler. You know, he's medium-fast rather than fast-medium. He can move the ball in the air and off the pitch. What I would slightly worry about is whether on a flat pitch he can have the same effects, and whether he's actually going to look a little bit kind of like a
I mean, I think Lord's was a real baptism of fire for him. I mean, it was really sort of batting conditions there, and he had to bowl a genuinely ridiculous number of overs, especially because in the first innings Sharma bowled fantastic well at the start of the second, but Sharma didn't bowl really well in the first innings. You know, a lot of far too wide outside off, really not testing the batsman. But Kumar just stuck at it, and maybe, I mean, part of the advantage perhaps of the pace he bowls at is an ability to kind of keep going.
Yeah. And there were some interesting, because looking back to the West Indies series particularly, some of the batting picks for India were quite interesting as well, weren't they?
Yeah, I mean, I think young sort of Abhinav Mukund, I mean, this is again where today's events, you know, he was dismissed for a golden duck today, which I feel very sorry for him. But I mean, I think he looked for me, you know, a really exciting prospect for India, just because he looks like a proper opener.
Until
until
he tries to get a swifty, plays at a wide run, and I mean the ball that he got out to in the first innings, when he could very very well have made a swifty and gone on to make a quite big score, because the England attack wasn't looking particularly ominous at that point. The shot he got out to, that thick inside edge back onto his stuff,
chasing
a very wide one, was slightly.
I mean, I guess. To what extent you forgive sort of youthful indiscretions. He was clearly nervous. I mean, I think a very similar thing happened to him in the West Indies. But I think, even with his golden duck today, I think he's a player who there is exciting potential. I mean, unfortunately, I mean, he will presumably go when Sehwag comes back into the side.
Yep.
But, you know, I think he's a sort of very, very exciting prospect there.
He's obviously one plank of this hugely vaunted Indian batting lineup, and one of the things that I think has changed so much since the first test is that they have lost their aura of invincibility. I mean, you would never have thought prior to the series, you'd never have put money on India being bowled out for under 300 twice on a Lord's pitch. And I think that is going to be one of the most significant things of the rest of this series.
The fact that has happened
is going to be a real sort of mental issue.
I mean, it's kind of hilarious. You know, when you took an Indian wicket and you would look at the next player coming in, it really was sort of a list of greats.
You could just imagine the bowler's heart sinking, particularly when Tendulkar came in further down the order in the last innings, and you sort of thought you've cracked the batting lineup.
I suppose, you know, Dravid is one player who hasn't really done his reputation any harm. I mean, his effort in the first innings, but there was a general sense at Lord's that India's batting lineup just isn't quite as terrifying as maybe sort of we thought, and I think that certainly has changed. I mean, I think one long-term change in terms of, you know, how sides are going to view overseas tours is that I think it will really rethink how much warm-up you need. There was clearly a sense with the Indian board that they'd had a three-test series in the West Indies, they could come here, play a game
and
at Somerset.
And they could hit the ground rolling, yeah.
Yeah, there was frankly a bit of a disaster, the game at Somerset. I mean, a lot of the players either just didn't fancy that or were just in terrible nick.
And also it meant that the batsmen didn't get any time in the middle because they were all bowled out.
No, exactly. And it will be very interesting to see, I think, in, you know, looking into the future, whether India would have, and maybe other test sides will look at it as well, you know, would India have the courage to do a similar thing again? I mean, England gave themselves a bit more of a warm-up ahead of the Ashes, and I think it's fair to say they paid dividends. You know, the batsmen were there. And I think there was a touch of arrogance, I think, about the way India kind of approached this. I mean, how do you think, in terms of expectations, there was always going to be this matchup, I suppose, between Swan and Harbhajan, the two sort of rival spinners. I mean, how do you think the view of that has changed post-Lords?
Well, Harbhajan, he only took one wicket today at Trent Bridge. He didn't take very many wickets at Lords. He didn't.
And Strauss gifted him, Lords.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that where England have been really successful with Swan is working out what his role is in the side. And when he first comes on, he's always a strike bowler, and everyone always talks about the way in which when he first comes on, he usually takes a wicket in his first over. And the reason for that isn't so much that Swan has a magic ability to do magic things of the fingers when they're not warmed up. It's because he's used very attacking situations of the game. He's not brought on when a batsman's running rampant and they need to contain a few runs. So I think England have really worked out what they want to do with Swan. I think Harbhajan essentially bowls too slowly for a lot of English pitches. I think he just, again, it's this issue of warm-ups that you were talking about. I just don't think he looks as if he's played on
Lincoln's
pitch for a long while.
I read a very persuasive piece on Harbage End, which basically argued that he's become too much a one-day spin bowler almost, and he does look uncomfortable in test format. To be fair, he was put under pressure, but by the injury to Zahir Khan. But I think he's a player who desperately needs to respond at Trent Bridge. I mean, I suppose more generally, the big change from Lords was that suddenly there became this real sense that this is England's series to win. What's happened today is I think that's been sort of turned on its head. And I think, you know, frankly, for anyone who's not, you know, who's sensible enough not to get carried away too quickly, I think we always knew that Lords was the start of what was going to be a long series. And I don't think I was, you know, overly surprised to see India fight back today.
No.
I think we'll see over the next few days the bowling conditions. This
is entirely going to be the kind of series that isn't dead until the last ball has bowled.
Yeah, and I think you'd have to assume a team of India's class were always going to respond. I mean, leaving the very serious world of India, England, and going to the fractionally less serious world of county cricket and fantasy county cricket.
This is serious stuff.
Tell us the tale of your last 2 weeks for the. What's the name of your team again? The reverse sweepers.
The reverse sweepers, I think.
Have the last 2 weeks gone for the reverse sweepers?
The reverse sweepers. They reverse swept themselves kind of backwards, I think, in the. As has been their wont since they actually since they've existed. Essentially, what happens is that I drop a player, I get rid of Ed Joyce or whoever, and it seems to be the kind of... I think because they're rejected by me, they feel they see it as a kind of real stimulation to go out and prove themselves as proper players. And so, basically, I'm just free-falling through the rankings as you're free-falling out the rankings. But
can you free-fall
out? Let's not be constrained by the fantasy cricket sides that we have. The wider point is that the county championship is hotting up very nicely indeed. Somerset's pulled off a pretty stunning victory against Durham to keep things very, very tight at the top of Division 1. And then there was that absolutely fantastic, last week there was that fantastic Roses match
that
between Lancashire
really was
and Yorkshire.
A superb game.
With both sides at various stages in the match being kind of 40 for 8 or something.
Because Yorkshire had no right really to be in that game. No. They'd fought back thanks to, I think it was Richard Pyro who hit a ridiculous, almost runnable 100 to get them back into the game. And then the second is you had a really good scenario where I think it was Shahzad and Rashid at the crease needing 70, 80 odd, and they got them sort of within sight. I mean, a really great game.
Now Rashid is one of your men, isn't
well,
he?
Well, he was. Rashid went, and Trezeggothic came in, and Marcus Trezeggothic, I mean, you can't help feeling slightly... He almost depressed by how successful he is in the county game. I mean, since joining the Jesus Green second 11, he's got 163 and 203. It's ludicrous. He's scoring more points than the rest of my batting lineup put together.
Yeah, you kind of wonder whether he's going to get a bit bored soon.
Well, it does
decide that he wants
a bit
of a sterner test in the international arena.
Obviously, we've talked in this podcast, we reviewed his book, and we've talked about the extraordinary struggle he had and the fantastic book he wrote documenting it. But you just cannot help feel that he's a player, you know, County Championship Division 1, which is a high standard of cricket, appears to be beneath him.
Yep.
He genuinely seems to be finding this too easy. My other star player of the last 2 weeks, slightly dubious one this, Samit Patel, thanks to a sort of interesting track at the Rose Bowl, ended up taking 11 for 111 over the two innings. He basically turned into Shane Warne.
Those are beautifully symmetrical figures.
It was beautiful. I was very happy. 1-1-1-1-1.
Yeah.
And that obviously gave my team a ridiculous boost. So I've bumped into 8,300 and something, which I think is my highest ever position. So I think you're what, sort of...
I'm about 15,000.
I mean, it's still competitive.
Oh, well, you're very kind. You're very kind.
But yeah, no, we'll see. James Harris, who I made captain, has actually done very little, except he has become, I think, the youngest ever Glamorgan player to take 200 wickets, which is very interesting, I suppose, if you're Welsh. But I wish
it's one of those stats for the anoraks, for the Bill Findles among us.
I wonder how James Harris celebrated it. I mean, was it a big deal for him?
Sure,
I wish I'd made Trezeggothic captain. I'd probably have won the weekly prize if I had. from the archives, and in the week of one famous England win over India, we're looking back at another one. It's 2006, it's the third test of the India versus England series, and we're in Mumbai. The post-2005 Ashes buzz was by this stage completely gone, I think it's fair to say. I mean, England went straight from that famous 2005 win to Pakistan, where they really had a pretty dreadful time of it. I mean, they lost the series 2-0, and they just lost it badly. They'd been well ahead in the first test, 130-run lead from the first innings, and still lost. And they were then really genuinely hammered in the third by an innings. By the time they get to India, they've just got all sorts of problems. Vaughan is out with injury, so no captain. And then vice-captain and sort of sensationally prolific opener, Marcus Trezeguet, has gone home after suffering the bout of depression. So Flintoff, the charismatic hero of 2005, is seen as the natural choice to lead the side. But I think it's fair to say that, you know, England go into that India series with low expectations. India is seen as not perhaps the best side in Test cricket at the time, but certainly one of the strongest. And Jen, you know, a tour away in England is, or in India, is always going to be difficult.
And I think you're exactly right about there being a kind of post Ashes crash at this point. And obviously, it reaches its culmination in the Ashes series at the end of that year.
And I think it's perhaps
also captained by Flintoff. And it's almost because we kind of chart those few years through those two Ashes series, the 2005 Ashes series with England on top and the 2006 Ashes series with England so far under the cosh of the Australians, that these games in between, that Pakistan series and the India series, get kind of lost.
I know, it's maybe a fault too often that we kind of give too much focus to Ashes series. That's how we define our England teams. But actually, I mean, I think this India series from the start, Flintoff's fairly young side actually does pretty well. I mean, they draw the first test at Nagpur and have the better of the game, which I think is sort of more than expectations. They do lose by 9 wickets at Mohali, but that actually belies the fact that for 4 of the 5 days, England were very much in the contest. So they go to Mumbai and even more problems. Alistair Cook, only 2 tests into his career, has a bit of Delhi belly, misses the third test. A shame, because he's had a century in the opener. And Steve Harmison, who, you know, his bounce in particular, key in these conditions, is out with an injury.
So what we have is a very kind of new look England side, and an England side that at first glance isn't about half the players who are playing in the series that we're playing at the moment. So we have Strauss and Bell bizarrely opening at the moment, and remember that this was the stage of Bell's career that Bell will want to forget about.
And Bell at that stage was everyone knew his potential, but he was sort of being tried in different positions. I mean,
Owe Shaw is another person exactly like that. He was being tried all over the place, whether he was a one-day specialist, what his role was in the Test team.
And this was his debut. Yeah. It was 5 years after his first ODI, so it kind of shows. I mean, you're right to the extent that England just hadn't found a Test role for him, and he finally got in for this game. And then the rather sort of odd entry of Sean Udall into proceedings.
Yes, with a very unprestigious test record to his name. England deciding to play two spinners, no Ashley Giles. Monty Panesar, whose place was a bit of a question mark at this stage. Ashley Giles was still hovering around on the edges.
Yeah, I mean, Panesar hadn't had a really great start in India. I mean, to be fair, you know, even if the conditions are favourable to turn, you've got batsmen who are very well equipped for it.
Exactly.
But
exactly.
England decided to go with 2 spinners.
And this new look England side goes into bat first in this third test of the series. Andrew Strauss leads from the front and makes a century off, pretty sort of arduous century off 240 balls in the end. Owe Shah on debut reaches 88 off 163 balls and then retires hurt because of the cramp that he has continued to get throughout his career.
He does return late.
He does return, but doesn't add much to his score. And England altogether managed to muster 400 runs between them. Andrew Flintoff as captain scoring a round half century. 400 probably being an above par score on this pitch. And then this India batting lineup comes in, and it's an Indian batting lineup which is actually, in a sense, very similar in prestige to the Indian batting lineup that we're seeing at the moment. Just to run through the top 6: Jaffa, Sehwag, Dravid, Tendulkar, Singh, and Dhoni. This isn't the kind of pitch attack lineup, sorry, that you want the batsman or bowlers. This isn't the kind of lineup that you want to be facing when you haven't got Harmas in your chief strike bowler. You've got Sean Udall, an ageing spinner who hasn't been doing particularly well, and Monty Panesar, who's a bit of a wild card.
But to be fair, the England seamers really rise to the occasion. I mean, Hoggard makes early break, I mean, gets Sayright and Jaffa pretty promptly.
Exactly, and then James Anderson, possibly spurred on by having been spurned for the 2005 Ashes and having been in and out of the England side for a long time before then, takes 4 for 40 off 19 overs, which really proves that to be the sort of decisive...
Well, I mean, you know, to pick up Tendulkar and Dravid.
And Dravid. Run out Dhoni when he's looking dangerous on 64 as well. So England lead by 120 on the first innings. The door's half open and they really need to capture lies on things, which they
it's
fail
tough going for England
pretty
in the second
spectacularly
innings.
To do. Anil Kumble returns startlingly good figures of 4 for 49 off 30 overs, which is an economy rate of 1.59. And basically, no one makes... Well, three people make into double figures for England. Sean Udall, batting as a night watchman at three, makes scratches out what I presume was a pretty ugly 14 or 51 balls.
But it's really the captain's innings from
Freddie. It's
from
the captain's
Freddie,
innings
it?
From Freddie Flintoff. A 50 off... I mean, this is one of the wonderful things that we kind of forget about Flintoff. He scores 50 off 146 balls, but still manages to score six fours and a six in it. So basically, he was scoring fours, sixes, and dot balls.
But I think this is the kind of innings that we really need to remember about Flintoff, especially now that he's, you know, he's gone. He's,
nope.
You know, he's not dead, but he's gone from the England centre.
Might as well
but
be.
I think we so often are inclined to remember those big sort of slap bang, sort of counter-attack innings. But this was a really brave innings that actually gave England a chance in the game because they were in danger of totally folding him. He was the only guy at 50. He top scored for the side. And as you said, I mean, really arduous stuff.
And in terms of the series, if England had capitulated here, which they could well have done, they were really staring down the barrel of total annihilation. So England muster 191 and they set India 313 to win. And here is where everything gets very interesting indeed. Because this batting lineup, Indian batting lineup, which you think is going to be, you know, going to be able to deal with this with no problem at all, and you think particularly when they get to lunch on the final day and they're 75 for three, and people are well set, and you think that this is going to be, you know, it's touch and go.
And you can also
see where India had
the spinners to make use of a spinning pitch. You know, they've obviously got Kumble who bowled so well. You know, if you're being frank, you know, Panesar and Sean Udall aren't the obvious pair to get through a test, a test Indian lineup. But
exactly. And then we have the marvellous account from the horse's mouth himself. Flintoff himself, after the game, declared that they listened to
Johnny Cash's Ring of Fire
in the dressing room, dancing around
in a scene that I don't
want to imagine. So, going from 75 for 3 at lunch, India eventually end up 100 all out. And the man who really does the damage, I would say, even though he doesn't have the best figures, is Flintoff himself, who takes 3 for 14 off 11 overs. And they're 11 kind of completely unplayable overs. I mean, you think back to the penultimate day at Edgbaston in the 2005 Ashes, when he sent down that last over when he got Ponting and Langer
before
him and then Ponting. Yeah. And it's that kind of, you know,
Wisdom describes it rather wonderfully as hurling thunderbolts. I mean, the thing is here, these are conditions that are just not built for Flintoff. You also think of him, you know, a day earlier, he's played this very tough 50 off 150 balls innings. He's had the stress of captaining a team under pressure. I mean, this for me
is leadership.
And now
there's this moment of sheer inspiration.
Yeah.
So you've got Flintoff, the maverick cricketer, doing this, hurling these thunderbolts at one end. And then you have Sean Udall with the most... I mean, is there a greater definition of a countryman, you know, a journeyman...
Journeyman county player.
County cricketer.
But, I mean, he gets Sachin, he gets Dhoni.
Yep.
He then picks off a couple of tail-enders.
And he ends up with 4 for 14 off 9.2 overs. So,
a key spell.
I mean, it's an amazing victory simply because... This England side is just a kind of rabble of misfits.
Yeah. I think that's fair.
It's just the way that it all comes together. And we know from having seen how the Ashes went in 2006, how Flintoff leadership can go wrong.
And here we see it going right. I think it's why this test needs to be quoted in his defence, because I think Flintoff the leader has basically been widely damned for 2007.
Not widely damned, I mean it's just been completely written
off. I think actually, you know, and he did have his problems, you know, it sounds like he really lost the plot during that series. To be fair, difficult conditions, but this was fantastic.
He did turn up to some practices drunk, I mean, that's
But I mean, this leadership seemed to be genuinely charismatic in times that were really difficult. I mean, for what, you know, I think England fans of our generation would find, the England team of the mid-90s, you just feel would have laid down and died in these circumstances. Yep. You know, lost players to injury, you're in India against this side. But what is fantastic is they turn up this third test and just give it everything. And I think it really deserves to be seen as a really momentous performance. I mean, it was England's first win in India for 21 years, unbelievably.
To the book review, and this week we are looking at John Nyren's The Cricketers of My Time. And we should start off by saying the cricketers of John Nyren's time aren't in any way the cricketers of our time. This was a book that was first published in 1832. It was serialised in 1833 in a journal called The Town. And
I think it's by a considerable distance the oldest book we've ever looked at on the show.
Oh, by a good 130 years or something like that. So it was the edition that was sort of long available was published in 1833, serialised then. But in 1998, a new edition came to light, which was from 1832, and had several passages in it that didn't make it into the final edited version. Several very interesting passages that we'll go on to talk about later. Essentially, what the book does is it explores and gives an account of Hambledon Cricket Club, which is in the wonderfully named Broad Halfpenny Down. It was supposedly the best club in England, and the author, John Nyren, was a cricketer there and was long associated with the club and knew a lot of the characters. It's one of these books where you sort of don't really know where to start, because there's just so much in it of anything and everything.
What's fascinating as well is that you're dealing with cricket at a time when it was very much still forming as a game. I think what's exciting is sort of looking back. I mean, I suppose it's always, you know, evolving. We look at sort of law changes all the time and argue about them. But this is a time where cricket is sort of gaining in popularity, and it's also, you know, it's in many ways not quite the game it is today. You're kind of seeing major decisions taken.
No, but there are two things there. One of which is, yes, exactly, it's about a time when the game was developing, and there's, in fact, Nyren gives an account of the time when they decided to change from having two stumps to three stumps, because when they had two stumps, if the ball passed between the two stumps, i.e. if you bowled someone's middle stump in inverted commas, because it wasn't actually there, then they weren't out. You had to hit.
This really was a bad
the leg, well, exactly.
You can imagine the leg Jimmy or the Anderson being very relaxed about that.
Yeah, exactly. So there are huge differences. But one of the things that has struck me reading it is actually some of the really striking similarities in, particularly, one of the things that Nyren does is he gives quite a long technical description of the game and how people should play and how the laws are, and there are so many similarities, so many things that jump out of you as being similar to the game today. For instance, when he's talking about batting, he talks about things like having a high left elbow, things like not trying to cut balls which are too close to your body, all the kind of things which...
What's fantastic about his batting guide is sort of the incredible specificness of it. I mean, we have how to stop a shooting ball dropped short of a length, how to play at a length ball a little wide of the off stump.
Yep.
I mean, it's fantastic in its specificness. I mean, I don't think I've seen a guidebook with that. And I think you're quite right, actually. There are several of the principles that actually a modern-day batsman could probably do quite well with.
And then there are some, as well as being those things which are sort of continued from the past, there are some striking differences. One of them is that the two stumps, and if you hit where the middle stump would be, then it's not out. But there are also these great accounts of... So you play a game against another village, you turn up, and the team that hadn't prepared the pitch, i.e. the away side, could choose exactly where the wicket was. So it could choose where to put the stumps. And so it became this great big tactical thing to decide exactly where you would want your bowlers to bowl. So if you had a particularly good spinner, you'd choose somewhere that was conducive towards spin, or something like that. Which
it does add a rather interesting element to it.
It does add a very interesting, and he also, and I mean, another difference is that he sees bowling over and round the wicket as being, in a sense, not different, apart from where the pitch kind of dictates it. So if you were a right-armer bowling to a left-hander, and there was a huge patch of rough sort of outside the left-hander's off stump, you might want to bowl round rather than over in order to...
I think a lot about the time can be said by the fact that he talks about how a good pitch, the outfield should be maintained by sheep.
Yep.
That they should feed carefully.
Exactly.
That should be a key part. That sort of key part. I mean, another area where I think it actually becomes quite modern is in some of his captaincy advice. He talks about, for example, if you've got two batsmen who you really can't remove, he says try and kill time, make changes in the field, try and disrupt the rhythm.
Yep.
And actually, I mean, I think that's, you know, some would argue whether that's very spirit of cricket.
Well, exactly. I mean, you have this vision of all cricket pre Packer era being this kind of wonderfully spiritual, gentleman form of the game. But there's that you talk about, and there's also a lot of betting that's ingrained in the game. And he talks about, he gives a description, the second part of the book is he describes the laws of the game as they currently stand. And a lot of them, betting is actually ingrained in them, and he gives us a little anecdote about some sort of financial backers of the Hambledon side who think that the side are going to win, and so swap their allegiance to the team halfway through, and then Hambledon do actually end up winning, and these backers get very sort of feisty about it, and insist that they should be paying them back because they didn't look as if they were going to win halfway through.
And again, it's fascinating.
And you kind of think bookmakers is written all over it. There's also a wonderful description which only came out in this earlier edition, the one which was discovered in 1998, which is the 1832 edition, which is not the original published 1833 one. One of the passages that was taken out of the 1833 edition is this this great thing about a batsman's mistress, which this little paragraph which he sort of tacks on to the end of a chapter describing this mistress who is the mistress of a batsman, but seems in some ways to be sort of shared by the team, and it's exactly this kind of stuff that you can imagine the son having a field day with now, which in fact is quite comforting to know.
It is, in a way, you're really striking a lot of continuity. You know, we're still fascinated in, you know, as a society, we're still fascinated in what our sportsmen get up to in the bedroom. I mean, I thought the other thing that was incredibly modern is when he launched a sort of diatribe against throwing in the game, against bowlers who chuck the ball. And he said, well, I understand that some people defend it because it makes the game shorter in length, you know, it gets batsmen out quicker. But he actually says, well, fine, you know, maybe we can look at other ways of doing that. Maybe we can make the bails wider and stuff. And it's actually kind of interesting because, in a way, it preempts a lot of the arguments we have today about test and one day. I mean, you know, how important is it how long a game of cricket lasts?
In short, I think it's quite refreshing to read this because it takes a lot of the issues that we've just talked about and puts them into a context that we're entirely unfamiliar with, because we're so familiar with talking about chucking and bookmakers and everything like that in the context of the modern game. But when you take it back to a pitch that is best kept by having a few sheep on the outfield, it's a wonderful sense of perspective, and actually it's an incredibly enthralling read.
From the blogs, and this week we're going to take a look at Cricket Equals Action Equals Art. Now, this blog is very different to really any blog we've looked at before on the show, in that it's very much sort of a photo-based blog. And I think we talk quite often about sort of what's unique about the blogs we look at, what kind of particular niche. And this blog really very openly says it's not as focused on its comment. It's much more focused on just picking out really interesting images of the game. And I think it's kind of important because, obviously, cricket journalism, the focus will always be on the opinion pieces, on the writing. But actually, I mean, cricket's a sport as much as any other where the photography has always played a really key part in how you depict the game.
And one of the great things about this blog is that it lets the pictures talk for themselves. It doesn't feel the need to sort of explain everything away. And it does do some slightly crazy photoshopping things sometimes. I mean, it's a combination. There are some old photos which are unearthed, which are fascinating in themselves.
And that's an interesting, that's kind of a very interesting effort in itself to try and dig out these old pictures. I mean, at the moment, for example, to kind of go along with the India series, we've got this selection of sort of very old India photos of India touring from just after the war. And they are kind of quite intriguing, these old images that, in their own way, just as much as a piece of writing, really sort of summon up the era. The photoshopping is kind of interesting because, I mean, I'm a million miles away from being a Photoshop expert. I think, some of the photoshopping exercises work really well, actually, in bringing something slightly new to the image. It's clearly something the author really, really enjoys doing as well. And I think perhaps it's important, really, in a cricket blogosphere that's full of comment pieces to give sort of photos some attention. I mean, do you think in this era of kind of cricket highlights, where we can all access these pictures and maybe the newspaper reports are slightly less important? I mean, do you think photos are less important now in terms of how?
No, I think the one of the great things about cricket, actually, in the book we've just been looking at on the back cover, there's a great image of a batsman, a sort of pencil sketch, I think it's a charcoal sketch actually, of a sort of early 19th century batsman. And actually, pictures can show you so much about the sort of atmosphere. There's a great picture on this blog actually of MS Dhoni at a press conference, and there's a kind of slightly hounded look in his eyes, and it's the classic example of a picture telling a thousand words.
I suppose one thing this blog does well is, I mean, you can go on Crick Info and find a million images of any game, but I think the real skill of this blog is it picks the good ones.
It filters them out for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly. It picks kind of the interesting ones. And I think, I mean, the sort of the other thing to know is I actually read something quite interesting recently that too much sports journalism sometimes focuses on the aftermath, on the celebrations. And we have got a couple of photos here of sort of celebrations, but actually there's a really good amount of sort of the action shots, the actual kind of moments.
It's interesting, isn't it, how often when you see photos in the paper that they are celebrations in all kinds of sport, in whether it's football or rugby or cricket or
it's odd that
anything
that kind of
it's always celebration, and it kind of makes you, I mean, there's a very interesting picture on here of some of the Indian batsmen in the nets lining up, and you sort of see one behind the other, and seeing the different ways that they all stand is actually quite an interesting sort
it's quite
of
odd as well, because it gets a sense of them all sort of paralleling each other,
yep,
doesn't it?
Yep,
all sort of
exactly.
Comparing. But certainly a blog that very much sort of deserves your attention, cricketactionart.blogspot.com. Something a little bit different within the cricket blogosphere.
So, the debate, and this week we're going to be looking at the question of the difference between an entertaining and a bad pitch. And of course, it's all a little bit topical after Hampshire were deducted points for a pitch they'd prepared at the Rose Bowl for a match.
The ECB described it as demonstrating excessive turn, was their judgment.
Demonstrating excessive turn, where, the ECB like everything to be metaphorically and literally straight down the line, as kind of child-friendly as possible. It's a question that's been around for a long time, particularly, I mean, we hear a lot about the increasing dominance of the bat. We see a lot of test matches in which batsmen stack up runs with impunity.
And I think it's a very common cause of complaint, actually, amongst fans, is that they're too often seeing batsmen, really good batsmen, having their lives made even easier by very good batting tracks.
What was interesting about this one is that, so the ECB said, that quote was that it demonstrated excessive turn.
Yeah.
Now, it's one. It seems to me there to be a difference between a pitch which is overtly dangerous, which is, for instance, the pitch that the that England came up against in the Caribbean 2 years ago, was it?
Right, when the test was actually called
abandoned
off,
after two overs, simply because the risk of injury to the bowlers and the, well, primarily to the bowlers.
And we've had we've had a county championship game actually this year where Worcester, I think it was at Edgbaston, where Worcestershire took a lot of injuries.
And, and so there's a difference between that kind of dangerous and the pitches that you saw some of when the that sort of much revered West Indies bowling lineup was around in the 70s and 80s. There's a difference between that and a pitch which just makes life very difficult to batsmen. And there seems to be something a little bit odd about saying batsmen are going to find it really difficult on this pitch and bowlers are going to find it easy. I mean, do the ECB find points for a pitch which gives excessive advantage to the batsmen?
I think that's a good point. If you create a road
that anyone can score runs.
I think the debate this week, I think, is going to turn into a polemic.
I think we agree.
I think there is actually. I think it would be fantastic if the ECB occasionally criticised a team or deducted points from a team for creating a non-competitive pitch.
And then Somerset would never get anywhere near the county championship ever
again. I particularly remember England's last tour to the West Indies, and some of the tracks they played on were just beyond the joke.
Yep.
And it, for me, someone who will follow England, you know, who love following Test matches, love following Test matches, I found myself ignoring some of the games in that series just because it was tedious grumbling. Everyone was racking up.
Whereas the latest test between England and India at Lord's seemed to me, even though Lord's is renowned as a batting pitch, it seemed to me to be a very good pitch because it offered every now and again a little something to the bowlers.
It had something for both.
There just seems to be this bizarre attitude, which is where the ECB seems to be coming from, which is that if batsmen are having a troublesome time, then the pitch is necessarily a bad one.
And I think you made the distinction. I mean, no one wants to see batsmen getting hurt on a pitch they can't deal with. What was very interesting here, Nottinghamshire came very, very close to winning the game. They fell just four runs short and it finished as a draw. What's fascinating, though, in that final innings, for all the turn, a couple of the Nottinghamshire batsmen really knuckled down, Vessels, Adam Vogue, and made scores in difficult condition. And actually, sometimes that's what batting should be about. And I think also what's great to see is that pitches should be allowed to have their own identity. You know, you should be able to watch cricket at different grounds and see something a bit different. I mean, how often in England do you see a pitch that demonstrates excessive turn?
Exactly.
It's quite a rare phenomenon.
And actually, we always talk about the need to be nurturing more spinners in England. But if we can't have pitches that turn, then it's not going to happen.
And in fact, we have two English prospects here, Danny Briggs and Samit Patel, who both benefited with good figures. I think we're sort of in agreement with this. It's a shame, in a way, to punish pitches, I think, that have a little bit of identity to them. Thank you for joining us again. We will be back in 2 weeks' time when this great England-India series will have moved on. You know, who knows? Tendulkar might have got that 100th 100 by then, at which point we can stop talking about it. But we will see you then.